You're listening to the Common Fan Podcast, a Husker football podcast for the common fan by the common fan.
Welcome back to the Common Fan Podcast. I am TJ Burkle, as always, with Maddie Owens Sr. and Geoff in Lincoln. Hey, real quick, get to the Common Fan website, www.commonfan.co. You can subscribe on YouTube, read all the articles, follow all the episodes, subscribe to all the social media accounts, and generally keep up with all the fun and frivolity of the Common Fans. That's commonfan.co. You also want to get your Common Fan socks before the season starts, Common Fans. Go to sillesco.com, S-I-L-L-I-E-S-C-O.com. Use the promo code GBR for life. That's GBR, number 4, L-I-F-E. And you can get 25% off not just your Common Fan socks, but any sock on the site. So if you want to go peacocking around the office, go to sillesco.com and get all the fun socks they have to offer. One more thing. This episode is brought to you by Champ Roofing. If you've got hail damage, ice damage, any kind of damage, or it's just time for a new roof, go to champ-roofing.com or call 402-858-7449 to get a quote. With unwavering commitment to quality and craftsmanship, Champ Roofing brings top-notch roofing services in Lincoln and throughout the state of Nebraska that withstand the test of time. Again, that's champ-roofing.com or call 402-858-7449 to get a quote. All right, gentlemen, this is episode 5 of TO, a series focused on the coaching career of one of the greatest ever, Tom Osborne. Up to this point, over the first 4 episodes, we've examined every part of Osborne's career, up to and including his first national championship team in 1994. We've been accompanied on this journey by some fantastic guests, including longtime sports writers and journalists Henry Cordes, Brandon Vogel, Mike Babcock, Ken Hambleton, and Mitch Sherman, along with multiple Husker legends, Tom Rude, to discuss the 1970s, Steve Taylor to discuss the 1980s, and Abdul Muhammad to discuss the early 1990s. For this episode, Dynasty, we'll examine T.O.'s final 3 seasons as head coach from 1995 to 1997. Both of our guests today played integral roles during those seasons. Grant Wistrom is in the College Football Hall of Fame, the Nebraska Athletics Hall of Fame, the Orange Bowl Hall of Fame. He's a Lombardi Award winner, 2-time All-American, 3-time national champion, a first-round NFL draft pick, a Super Bowl champion, and the recipient of a boatload of other high honors and recognitions.
You need like a scroll for all that. You need like a roll out a scroll.
Take a breath, TJ. Take a breath.
Yeah. I'm just going to keep you around, man. Be my hype man. I love it.
He'd be a good one.
Friend of the program, Tom Chattel, is a longtime writer at the Omaha World Herald, author of multiple books, and a giant among the Nebraska press corps. Guys, this is the Common Fan Podcast. Are you sure you're in the right place? I'm not even sure Geoff graduated from high school. I'm being honest.
What the hell is your problem? I do want to say this. In terms of high school, Mr. Wistrom, you were on arguably the greatest college football team of all time. I, too, am a champion. I was on the greatest intramural Pius X basketball championship team of all time. So we do have that in common. So
hey, game recognizes game, man. I appreciate it, Geoff.
Geoff, I'm sorry I didn't mention that at the beginning, Geoff.
You should have.
feels like a miss on my part. Tom, how are you today?
Good. I will say right off the top that Grant was on the inside of all this stuff, and not only the greatest team, but maybe the most memorable season for good or bad reasons. I was on the outside, certainly. I was there every day, but I could tell you what happened on the outside, and a lot happened on the outside. But certainly, Grant will tell you everything that happened inside, and I'm anxious to hear some of those stories too.
Love it.
Well, we were 13 at the time, so we were definitely not on the inside. So we're excited to get both the perspective from both of you. So picking up where we left off in the last episode, of course, T.O.'s teams in 1993 and 1994 were both excellent. They both went undefeated in the regular season, both played for national championships. Obviously, the 94 team won it all. Each of those, though, like had some close calls, some nail biters, you know, some unexpectedly close games, let's say. The 95 team was an entirely different story. Arguably the greatest college football team of all time. And I have argued that many times, I might add, on Twitter and in various bars across America. The 95 team averaged over 53 points a game and gave up just 14 and a half. They averaged more than 556 rushing yards per game. No team came within 14 points of them on the final scoreboard. Of the top, of the three top 10 teams they played during the regular season, they won 49-25, 44-21, and 41-3. And then, of course, completely dismantled number two, Florida, in the Fiesta Bowl. We're going to get to all the teams, 95, 96, and 97. Obviously, that 95 team is the place to start. Grant, let's start with you. Interesting to note, one of our sources for this whole series has been Henry Cordes' fantastic book, Unbeatable, about those teams in the 90s. That 1995 team only returned eight starters from the national championship team the year before. Did you feel like you had something special at the outset? Did you know you would be so dominant? And what made the team so dominant?
You know, I don't think anybody realized where we would end up. You know, after coming off the national championship the year before, there wasn't any sort of complacency on the team. And I think that was probably the best thing we had going for us. It was like, hey, that's great. Let's go get another one. You know, nobody was celebrated. I mean, we all celebrated and enjoyed it and appreciated it and respected it. But at the same time, it was like, there's more work to do. There's still a lot of talent in this locker room. We're not a one and done team. So there was just a refocusing and a rededication after winning that first one that it was just, there was no question. It was just like, we're going to go out and run the table again.
That's awesome, dude. Tom, I got a question for you. Actually, you had mentioned that Grant can give us all the info about the inside. Let's get some information about the outside. What do you remember about going into that season, Tom? We know Husker Nation can never get enough winning. We're frothing at the mouth every year, even during all the eras post-Tom Osborne. What was it like from a media perspective and a national perspective and that sort of thing?
Well, I'll tell you what, that was Tom's first national title. A lot of people didn't know, what was next? How do you react to this? How do you cover this? As I recall, there were a couple storylines going into that year. People were kind of focused on one. I don't believe there had been a back-to-back national title in a long time. I don't think Miami ever went back-to-back. I could be wrong there. But it had been a long time, I believe. And also, Tommy Frazier was back, and he was healthy. And for a guy that, you know, a year earlier, you go to the Meadowlands, you play West Virginia, he comes out of that game, the New York papers are all hyping him as he's already won the Heisman, give him the Heisman. I mean, and this was going to be his year. And, oh, by the way, where does Brooke Berger go? Well, he goes backup. And I remember in that August, there was a quarterback competition. Tom played it out, as he always would, fairly. And, you know, I remember they went down to the last scrimmage. He said, well, I guess Tommy's going to start. And that's how Tom announced the starter. Well, I guess Tommy will do it. And but, you know, I don't we didn't know. We didn't know what we had. You know, they lost the offensive line, maybe the best they ever had, and several other people. We didn't know quite what we had until we went to East Lansing. The first game, I think, was Oklahoma State, Stillwater, late August, Oklahoma Heat. They ran out, ran over Oklahoma State like they always did. So we thought, well, this is just business as usual. We didn't, Lawrence Phillips was an interesting character in that he had, 93 played, 94 emerged as a guy who helped win the Orange Bowl. But he hit another level. I think we knew at the end of the Michigan State game when Tom famously told Nick Saban, "You aren't as bad as you think," because we're really good. I think we left that the press box that night thinking, "Holy crap, we got something here that we haven't seen."
Love that.
Yeah. Well, you know, for so long, Coach Osborne was known as kind of the guy who couldn't win the big one. Going into 95, after finally getting a ring, was there anything different about Coach Osborne? Did he change his process or his message? I'd love to get the take from both of you on that, starting with Grant.
Well, I know you guys are young and probably don't remember a lot of it, but
not Coach me. Osborne.
Well, yeah, Tom, you remember all of it. But Coach Osborne never changes message, regardless of the situation, regardless of up, down, didn't matter. The message was always the same. So to say that, you know, even in when the was, you know, couldn't win the big one, the mystique around him, the message was always the same. We're going to go out, we're going to practice hard, we're going to prepare well, we're going to have you ready to play on Saturday, and we're going to go out there and give our best effort. And he just, wherever, whether it was praise coming our way or shade coming our way, it was always the same. And it's just was always just such a steadying, calming influence throughout the whole team. And you had other coaches out there that were the fiery coaches, but Coach Osborne was just stoic and just steadfast for every year he was at the helm.
Love it.
Yeah, and I would, to echo that too, Grant, in the previous episode, one thing that's consistent with Tom Osborne, I think, is that he cared about making you a good person first and a great football player second. He was just seemed like a really good guy.
Well, yeah. I was really fortunate pretty much throughout every place that I stopped to had coaches like that, that cared for you more as a person than they did as a player. They wanted you to succeed as a human being more so than on the field. And, you know, Coach Osborne, you know, I'm sure we'll get into it later, but he always stood by his players, whether it was going to reflect negatively upon him or not. He stood by guys through their darkest times because that's what they needed. And he put his personal legacy at risk when he did those things from time to time, but it didn't matter to him because he cared about you more as a person than anything about him.
Yeah. Tom, anything to add to that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I thought that was well said. Tom Osborne is probably the most consistent person I've ever known in my life. And that consistency was tested that year in a big way over and over and over. Tom put himself in the crosshairs. He put himself at risk because of that consistency. And, we saw that guy. I think I learned more about Tom Osborne that year than I had ever any year, any time. Because he didn't blink, and there were plenty of times to blink. There were plenty of times for him to change and, compromise his standards. Everybody said he was doing, but he wasn't. It was an amazing time. You know, you forget when we left the Orange Bowl previous January, 94 season, 95 Orange Bowl. People in college football were celebrating Nebraska, celebrating the coach who finally won one. You know, the man about hard work and consistency and, you know, the guy who can never push the boulder all the way up the hill, finally got one. And it was a celebration. And a year later, it was the opposite. The national media were tired of him. They were mad. People were angry. It cost Tommy Frazier the Heisman. I guarantee it did. There were the outside noise. I mean, thank God it wasn't email or Twitter, because
yeah,
you know, my head would have exploded because I put myself in the middle of it too, which is kind of my job. But it was a fascinating year But I always tried to step outside a little bit and pay attention to the coach at all times. And remarkable, maybe his best coaching job ever, mm-hmm. because of what he put himself through. It was his deal. But he, you know, that team had leaders everywhere, and Tom leaned on him, but his consistency got them through that season.
Love it.
So let's talk about, it's been hinted at. I think everyone knows where we're going. I remember that Michigan State too, the Michigan State game, Tom too, and watching it and just how dominant LP was. And I thought he was going to be a front runner for the Heisman. Of course, that's that night the team gets home, and in the wee hours of the morning, Lawrence Phillips is hanging out with teammates. He gets a phone call. A young lady he had previously had a relationship with is at Scott Frost's apartment. We won't go through every detail. Again, the Henry Cordes book does a fantastic job of sort of laying out the play-by-play. If you're interested in that, I think most Husker fans know the story. Phillips goes to Frost's apartment. He breaks in. Sort of a scuffle ensues with him and Frost. Phillips ends up assaulting the young lady and dragging her out of the apartment. Thankfully, Frost was able to call 911, and they were able to sort of push Phillips out, and he fled. That's a very brief summary. Again, if you want to read Unbeatable by Henry Cordes for all the details, that's in there. Of course, this changes the season. It changes the team forever. It changes probably the program forever. Becomes national news very quickly. Probably the most challenging thing Coach Osborne had ever had to deal with, I would guess. That was sort of Saturday night into Sunday morning. By Sunday night, Osborne has issued a statement saying Phillips is off the team. But less than 24 hours after that, there's a little more gray area. And T.O. seems to be softening. He's referring to it as more of an indefinite suspension and not an outright dismissal. Tom, what do you recall about those first few days when the story broke? Sort of the, is he on the team? Is he off the team? Suddenly the national media is descending on the state. What do you recall about all that?
Well, first of all, I can't remember how I found out about it. I don't remember, you know, nowadays it would be social media, right? It was stunning because he was a guy that, you know, A, he had incredible talent, and you're right, he put on a show in East Lansing, and we're thinking, okay, Nebraska's going to win the Heisman, but maybe it won't be Tommy. Maybe it's going to be Lawrence, because you throw his backstory in, and he basically grew up homeless in L.A., and he bounced around a lot. That's, to go from that to the Heisman is a story a lot of people, national media, were going to get behind and want to write that story, and they were going to come to Lincoln to do the Lawrence Phillips story all year. Oh boy, did they ever, but not for that reason. But I remember, I believe George Darlington spoke at a lunch. They had a Monday quarterback club lunch in Lincoln. I think it was George's turn, and I think he recruited Lawrence. Maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe it was Tom who spoke. But I just remember George was being quoted a lot because he recruited Lawrence, telling his story, telling what he went through and all the hardships, and not excusing anything, but just giving a little context to it. The year before we had Tommy's blood clots that really shocked the world. This was another shocker. But it was, it was a hard column to write, and I didn't have all the facts. And, my stance, and I'd love to get Grant's take on this, because I'd love to know when he found out and what that reaction was in the locker room, throughout the whole thing. But my take was, if you want to keep Lawrence on the team around structure, the dining hall, his friends, his support group, and not throw him to the wolves. I'm okay with that, but he should never play again. And so I wrote that, and I started getting mail. No emails back then. I started getting letters, phone calls, people, you know, threatening me and calling me names. And that's part of the deal. But I can talk about that later, too. But I'd like to hear Grant's take on that.
Yeah.
You know, we'd gone through adversity the year before with Tommy's injury and coming in. So, you know, luckily we had experience with it. So when that happened, you know, obviously first, you know, your immediate reaction is, oh my gosh, you know, what, you know, is she okay? You know, and then when Lawrence is off the team, like, oh man, what are we going to do now? Cause just like, you know, everybody saw, like, this is one of the best running backs in the country and we just lost him. But at the same time, there's, you know, we still had a game to prepare for the next Saturday. So there's no time to sit there and feel sorry for yourself. Luckily, at that time, Nebraska had a stable of running backs, you know, nobody of Lawrence's caliber. But still, we had Damon Benning. We had Clinton Child. You know, we had a lot of, Amon, I believe, was on that team as well. We had a lot of great running backs still there to fill the role. So it was just like, you know, once you get through the initial, woe is me, woe is us, it's like, okay, you know, we got a game to get ready for. So there's no time to wallow in that. It's like, in next Saturday's coming, whether we want it to or not, we got to start preparing to play. So that's what it was. It was just a refocusing and rededication to everything, coming together as a team, realizing that other players are going to have to step up. Defense is probably gonna have to start playing a little bit better. But at the same time, there still wasn't a loss of hope. You know, we've replaced, you know, the best player in college football the year before, and we won football games, won a national championship. We can do this again.
Yeah. So was somebody going to jump in there, Jim?
I was curious just because you're talking about then not going to wall in it. You got to move forward and the impact on the team in the locker room. Do you know, and you don't have to go into two in detail or whatever you're comfortable with, but like, did the team support Phillip's punishment? Were they on board with that?
Yeah, I can't really remember, but I don't think there was a lot of focus on that.
Yeah.
It was, you know, hey, we still have to go and play. We've lost Lawrence. You know, we understand that. We don't know if he's coming back, you know, so who's next?
Gotcha.
And, you know, and every position set up like that, you're one play away from being the starter.
And next man up.
Yeah. And luckily at the time we had enough numbers that, you know, we would run four full team stations the entire practice. So guys were getting lots of reps preparing for that, you know, like you just said, next man up. So, you know, I, once again, you lose one of the best players in the nation, but we were loaded with some of the best players in the nation anyway. Right. So there was somebody behind them that could step up.
For sure. So Phillips ended up serving a 6-game suspension. Coach Osborne insisted that he get counseling, he continue with school. He had to meet a certain number of metrics before he could come back. He returned for the Iowa State game. So he played against Iowa State, Kansas, Oklahoma, to end the season, and then he was in the bowl game against Florida. Another thing that came up that, Tom, I'm sure didn't help the national media narrative that you referenced is several other players had off-the-field incidents as well. And I think there started to emerge a national narrative that Coach Osborne was tolerant of these things in the name of winning. I think it's hard to, like, everyone acknowledges his integrity. He's driven by his faith, I think, something he's talked about a lot. So where do you, like, I'd be curious, either of you really, how do you square that circle, or where does that come down, or is that fair? I mean, in Cordes's book, he even references some players from other teams that, you know, maybe did similar things or worse things and were getting 1-game suspensions or whatever else. And nobody was talking or writing about that. So maybe the criticism of Osborne was unfair, but I'm curious where both of you guys come down.
Well, there was, you know, it was interesting. I think certainly those things happened. And I don't know, again, we weren't, Christian Peter, I don't know enough detail about any of that. Abdul Muhammad, just things that, you know, Riley Washington, just things, you know, that there was a gun that Tom had in his office. I mean, these that we never got enough answers on some of these things, but they did pile up. And I could tell you from a media standpoint, when you lay a hand on a woman, that is going to bring a lot of heat. It's not many bad things worse than that. Maybe nothing worse than that. So year before, Tom's on top. Sometimes when you're on top, people like to knock you down, and certainly not going to, you know, excuse any of that, but it was this thing where, okay, all these things are happening, you know, and it's easy to you know, look at Tom and go, okay, maybe this is why they're winning, or this is what they're about. And everybody took their shots. I mean, back then, again, there's no Twitter, no internet. I'm going on the wire service on my computer every day, reading columns from New York and Philly and Chicago and L.A. and Dallas, and they're all taking their shots at Nebraska and Tom. And then they started coming to Lincoln. And I don't think Grant was really around this, but the day that the circus came to town, Bernard Goldberg, not even a sports guy for CBS, he was like with 60 Minutes or CBS News reporter. I mean, we walk into the Tuesday press conference and the old big red lounge, and there's all these lights set up, and there's this guy in a suit, and we go, oh, what's this deal? And it was Bernard Goldberg who's going to do a gotcha question. And the lights came on, and he asked Tom, if this was your daughter, would you do the same thing? Would you be doing the same thing with Phillips? And boy, I've seen Tom get red. He got double red for that question. And he was very flustered, very upset. I said, I'm not going to answer that here. I will talk to you out in the hallway later if you want to. And then he ended, and he did. And of course, Goldberg's filming the whole thing. It was part of his story. It's what he wanted. And then he went on the air. He filmed a report from the stadium. This is a win at all cost program, blah, 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 blah. And these are the kind of things that were happening. But I also remember, and interestingly enough, years later, Bernard Goldberg became friends with Jason Peter, and he came back and did a report for Real Sports on HBO about Osborne in Nebraska. They really weren't that way. But, you know, I always said, okay, if people wanted to say Tom, you know, Lawrence Phillips was the poster boy for Tom Osborne. So wait a minute. What about Grant Wistrom's? What about Tommy Frazier's? What about all these guys that are doing it right and getting, you know, great academics? They're graduating. They're model citizens. There's, you know, 99% of the guys that are coming to Nebraska are like that. You know, what, you know, everybody labeled this guy for this one thing. And I'll never forget a friend of mine, Mike Kern. We worked for the Philadelphia Daily News. He came in to do a story, and he's talking to Tom out in the hallway after the press conference. I'll never forget Tom's quote to him. He goes, I'm either way ahead of my time or else way behind. I thought that was a hell of a quote.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think so. It's well documented that Osborne basically said he felt like football was the only organizing factor in Phillips's life. And without it, he'd be completely lost and thrown to the wolves. I think generally speaking, he felt like football was a net positive in all these guys' lives. And it reminded me of, that famous clip of Nick Saban talking about Moose and Muhammad. And you've all probably seen it. It's on YouTube if you want to see it. But he says, I saw Moose and Muhammad the other day, and he got in trouble when he played for me. And everybody wanted me to kick him off the team, and I didn't do it. And guess what? He played X number of years in the NFL, and now he's the president of a company, and he has however many children, and his daughter is at Princeton. And so, you know, Saban's kind of defiantly standing there. Where do you want him to be? Do you want him to be in the street, or do you want him to be graduating? And I genuinely, personally, fundamentally believe that's sort of the same approach of Coach Osmoor, of basically coming from a place more than anything else of caring about these guys. And again, it's not something we brought up a ton on this series, but if you read his books, sort of his faith is woven through isn't everything that he does. And I think that's a major factor too, right? Forgiveness and opportunity, second chances and all these things.
Right. Everybody would like a second chance, but far less people are willing to give somebody else one. Right.
Right. Now I would say this is just me, Tom. I what you said earlier resonated with me for sure. I also think that's why, and maybe that's the way it would be in 2025. I think that's why decisions need to be taken out of the hands of coaches sometimes. Sometimes you get second chances for some things, but on this one, I think you could very much make the case that he probably should have never played again. But I do think the motivation was coming from a place of, you know, the Henry Cordes books talks about T.O. visiting Phillips in jail when he was in California for a bowl game about 09, 2010. He never gave up on the guy, I guess, is the point.
Right? Yeah. I'll just say one more thing about this. Four years later, Tom has retired for 2 years. He's going in the College Football Hall of Fame. They put him in first ballot. I called him up and I'm doing a column on him. And I said, Tom, I said, would you do it's only been 4 years. Would you do all that again the same way? And I said, did you learn anything from that? And he goes, what I learned is you can't save everybody. But that doesn't mean you don't try. And I love that quote. It defined him. He was doing it for the right reasons. I really believe that. The first play of the Colorado game, Amon Green down the sidelines, you know, Skippy Neuheisel's got his mouth open. You know, the first play of the game is 7-0. It's Lawrence Phillips was an unbelievable, but they had another unbelievable. They had two or three unbelievables. So Tom was not doing that to win, but I believe he's also stubborn, and he's going to prove that he was right, and that he could do this. And so, like, that was a little part of it too. But there's the consistency where he follows him to the prison in L.A. and he's writing letters to him and he's standing by him. The consistency that defined Tom Osborne's life and career. And again, my only regret on this thing is this was a special team. And I thought they got overshadowed by this story. I don't think they got the credit that they, in the moment, they didn't get the credit because there too many people were angry. Too many people didn't like them. People hated Nebraska in the media. And they didn't, this team was so special, didn't get the credit. I mean, I thought that they should have.
Do you feel like that also lent to what we put out on the field? Because I do feel that we did. I mean, that did bring us together. It was a unifying thing for the team, and not the incident in itself, but the heat and the shade that we were catching from every media pundit outside of Lincoln and even some within Lincoln. You know, it was like, all right, screw these guys. Let's just go out and do it again. We're going to run the table regardless of who's on the field. So I do think there was a resolve there that incident helped fortify.
Sure. Well, speaking of running the table, moving forward to the Fiesta Bowl, number one, Nebraska versus number two, Florida. It's Husker power versus Florida's fun and gun offense. I remember at least as a kid being, you know, obsessed with what was going on. It was expected to be a close game is my recollection. I think there was still that lingering narrative that Nebraska was going to have a hard time with Florida's speed, which had been a problem in the late 80s and early 90s for the Florida schools. Lee Corso suggested that playing on grass might slow the Huskers down. which I found comical to revisit after the fact. Of course, we know what happened. The Huskers win 62-24 in a completely dominant performance. Grant, in the last episode when we talked to Abdul Muhammad, one thing he talked about, kind of laughed about, was how hard the team practiced going into the Orange Bowl the year before. And like how literally guys are like taking shots at Tommy, you know, in the Orange Bowl practice. Like nobody, no green jerseys, nobody gets a pass.
Yeah.
Did the team take a similar approach going into the Fiesta Bowl?
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at Shopify.com/RedCircle, all lowercase. Go to Shopify.com/RedCircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/RedCircle.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Every practice was that way. It was just full tilt every practice, hitting every practice, and it's kind of weird. It's a new era and just the way the practices are run. It was just full live bullets every time we practiced. And it was like that all the way up until that bowl game. And you were just frothing at the mouth to go out and play. You know, you're ready for these practices to be over with. You're just wanting to go out and hit somebody else because you've been banging heads with the same guys for the last month. You're just ready to go out and tear somebody else's head off.
Yeah, and I think what Abdul kind of said there too was you guys would go so hard at each other, and you know, arguably you were on the greatest college football team of all time, that if you're having players like that running as hard as they can against each other, going up against another team after that almost seems like light work to start, not to diminish like other teams, but when you guys are hitting each other that hard, other teams don't seem as bad.
Yeah. Oh, you're in a safe space. You can diminish other teams here if you're in a safe space. Games slowed down on Saturday. You know, we faced better talent on our practice field than lots of, you know, starting teams that we would, you know, even going against our scout team or our number twos. Lots of times I was going against a better play on our number twos than I'd face on a Saturday. Yeah. So it was just, we were deep and we were physical and we were prepared every Saturday to play.
Love it. TJ brought up the dominating score, and yeah, that is shocking, especially in a national title game like that, just to disparage like the discrepancy and talent there. But Tom, I'm curious, just from a media standpoint, were you surprised at the level to which Nebraska just absolutely dominated that game? Did that surprise you at all?
Well, no. If I may, I don't want to hijack this podcast. I'm the guest, but I'd like to bring this up and maybe ask Grant about this. To me, the performance of the year was at Colorado, and it was the game of the year. It was their best game of the year. I think they won 45-21 or 44, but they didn't have a penalty. Everybody raised their level. I'll never forget I've talked with Tommy about this before. Tommy, is that run in Florida? You probably get asked about the run against Florida. And he said he doesn't like that run. He doesn't want to talk about it. He said it doesn't count because those guys quit. He goes, his favorite play was at Colorado that year when he got hit. I think it was Matt Russell, a Colorado linebacker, came in and socked him. And Tommy held on to the ball and still completed the key third down pass. I said, I remember that play. That was a hell of a play. And that's his favorite play. But to me, and I'd love to know what Grant thinks about this. Before that game, if you were there, you remember this. It was New Heisel's first Nebraska game. They had a Samoan warrior, a guy dressed up. He was actually like a Samoan, big Samoan wrestler or something.
Yeah.
Dressed up in a warrior outfit, pounding war drums outside where the teams ran out of the field. And Colorado's in there, they have their flashing wartime on the scoreboard while this guy's beating on these drums. And the crowd's going nuts at Folsom Field. And here the Buffs are running. Buffs entered the field through the stands. They run down through the tunnels, through the students and the fans. They're coming down the steps, their black jerseys, and the place is going out of their mind. And I heard a quote. I heard that Tom told you guys, I don't know if this is true or not. He said, if you have to do all that, you don't think you can win. I love that quote. If it's Trump, it's true. Is that what he said?
I think it was something like that. And it was, if I remember correctly, it was Big Van Vader with a WWF wrestler.
I remember that.
Okay. I think he might have played football in Colorado. But yeah, no. My favorite story from that game, like you guys have been out to Folsom Field. I'm like, when you're sitting on the bench, the first row of the seating, their knees are in your back. I mean, their fans are right on top of you. And so we're driving into the stadium, and I've never seen so many old ladies giving one-fingered waves to us as we're pulling in. And we get out there, we're on the field, and there's a point in the game where the defense is sitting on the bench, and there's a guy about two rows behind us who just keeps chirping the entire game. And he starts yelling stuff at Jason. And finally, he said something about Jason that hit a nerve. He said something about Christian to Jason. He's like, hey, where's your blankety blank brother? And Jason just turns around and looks at the guy. He's like, probably out blankety blanking your daughter right now or your sister or something like that. This guy tries to come over the railing, and we're all just like, please, please sit down for 1 second. But it was I love Jason. I love him like a brother, but that I'm going to carry that memory to my grave. Like just that whole, and it's how quick he was with it. And that just shut that guy down so fast. It was awesome.
Wow. Classic Buff fan right there.
Yeah. It was awesome.
Yeah. To answer your question about the Florida game. There was people all week talking about how Florida was going to dominate Nebraska. There's videos now, ESPN guys back then saying that. Interestingly about speed, and they just beat Miami the year before with a great defensive performance on the Orange Bowl turf, which is basically sand. I mean, I've been down that Orange Bowl field where it was like sand that was like dirt that was like painted green. So it's Miami could run on it, but. So they've handled that before, but people thought, you know, Florida, Spurrier, the super team, the new dynasty, and that safety, you know, again, their safety in a big game. But yeah, that I was surprised. I just memories of that game to me, right in the middle of the game, right for Tommy's run. I'll never forget. I'm back in the back getting another Diet Coke or something. And three or four writers came up to me and said, man, I wish I'd have voted for Tommy for the Heisman. I should have voted for Tommy. And these guys, just, I said, yeah, I know. But, you know, you didn't because everybody was mad at Tom. They're mad at Nebraska. They're tired of him. They didn't want him to get the Heisman. They didn't want, you know, nothing against Eddie George. Tommy Frazier was the best player in college football that year. unless it was Grant, of course. But you know, after that game is just my memories of that game were the domination and Christian Peter taking the like a fumble or something, and he's strutting into the end zone, and people were laughing and in the press box, and well, some of the national guys were mad. They're just always mad. They were mad at Nebraska that year. So, but after the game, we're up there. You know, I one of us couldn't go down to the interview because of the deadline. And Tom is being interviewed, or his press conference. He starts off by laying into the Big 12 and the Big 12 presidents and this new league that they had to join. And he was mad about it, and they were changing the rules and the partial qualifiers, and they're doing this to the conference office and the new committee. And people are going, you just won back-to-back national titles, and you're worried about the Big 12? What are you doing? And then that just – Tom was worn out, and he was just – you know, he did it to himself, but it just sort of kind of started to unravel and started to come out. And the next morning they had a press conference. Always have the press conference for the winning coach at the next morning. And Tom showed up, and we're at the Mission Palms Hotel ballroom. He comes in. It's like he hadn't slept in a year. And he was tired eyes, and he was depressed, and he just had no energy. And I thought, man, and he was just he was really sad. It was just, to me, it was a sad moment because it was his greatest team and his greatest moment. And he just was worn down by everything. And I'll never forget that.
Wow.
Well, guys, what do we think? I know we're biased, but greatest college football team of all time, right? 1995. I don't know if anyone can really compare. I mean, 2001 Miami was pretty good, but they weren't the level of you guys in 95.
Yeah, it was a special team, man. And you know, I think there's probably other teams with more talent, perhaps, but I doubt there's very few teams that played as hard as together as we did.
Yeah, 100%.
So, fast forward a little bit. Spring of 1996, vibes are sky high. Nebraska's the undisputed national champion. Spring game weekend, NFL draft weekend. Brooke Berenger, even though he'd been a backup, is being talked about as a likely mid-round draft pick. And instead, of course, Husker fans get the shocking news that he and his girlfriend's brother have died in a plane crash. What do you guys remember about that?
Tears.
Tears. It was, I think it was a Friday, perhaps it happened. Because I remember Jason and I were sitting in our apartment, I think, when it all went down. And I just picked up my phone and called my brothers and my mom and my dad. Because it's just life is fleeting, you know, and just don't know that today's my last one. And for a guy that did everything right, I mean, I've never heard a bad Brooke story. Whether it was an encounter with someone or anything, I've never heard a bad Brooke story. So, and just quite the contrary, everything is just above board. Like, oh my God, like, you know, it's Mother Teresa, you know. And to see, you know, he was about ready to have his moment. You know, he'd been the ultimate team guy for 4 years, and he was getting ready to have his moment. And for that to happen, it definitely impacted me that day, and it still, you know, impacts me to this day. You know, you just don't know. And so just appreciate everything you have, appreciate everyone in your life, and just make sure they always know how you love them.
Yep. Well said.
Well said.
Yeah. Grant, I think it was, a Thursday, cause I remember I did a Thursday radio show with Gary Java in Omaha. We were at the old Scorecard bar in Miracle Hill area, whatever, but and we were on break, and somebody, the show's producer was just like, guys, we just got word of something. I don't know if it's true, but it's horrible. And he said it, and my heart sunk. And I thought, well, I don't know. I'm sure we'll hear about this soon enough if it's true or not. Then I had to go down. It was the hardest thing I've ever had to write. And I sat in front of my computer and just stared for minutes, you know, almost an hour. And, you know, what do you say? And, yeah, I mean, to me, Brooke was, even by not playing much in 95, was as big a part of that story. The way he handled not winning the job and going back to being the backup after the previous year, the way he handled that, the consummate team player, was as big a factor in that year as anything. He could have made it ugly. He could have made it hard, and he didn't. And yeah, he was going to have his moment. And then I remember the spring game, the moment of silence, and they played a video of Brooke, and finished it up by he's reading Green Eggs and Ham to a bunch of school kids. And I mean, we were bawling in the press box. It was, that was something else.
Yeah. Well, and his, you know, still talked about today, his impact still felt today with the statue and the, what do they do? The Citizenship Award, the Brooke Berringer Citizenship Team Award and all of that. But to Grant's point, just completely unfair for such a good guy and a young guy with so much in front of him.
Yep.
So the 1996 team comes into the season looking to three-peat, which had never been done before and still has never been done to this day. Spoiler alert. Frazier's graduated, and the Huskers will be led by a new quarterback by the name of Scott Frost. You know, in looking back at the season, guys, I was struck by a couple of things. Nebraska has the shocking loss to Arizona State, 19-0. Of course, that ASU team would end up being undefeated and Pac-10 champions. The Huskers go 10-1 in the regular season in the inaugural year of the Big 12. And by the time of the conference championship game, they've clawed back to number 3 in the country. So still a shot to play for the national title. Nebraska would lose to a Texas team. What I think they were 7-4, something like that. So kind of a shock in the conference championship game loss. And then, of course, go on to beat Virginia Tech in the Orange Bowl. So somewhat disappointing when compared to the previous three seasons. First thought is, though, how much would we kill for 11-2 right now?
Yeah, we would.
Yeah. But second of all, you know, there's a fair amount in the Cordes book, and I remember this, about, you know, how poorly Frost was treated after the ASU loss, how angry fans were. Grant, I'm curious just how Coach Osborne handled it all, and, you know, how you guys handled that year, which, you know, you had a lot of success, even including 93, you know, a field goal away from a national title. This was kind of new for you guys.
Yeah, it was new to the state of Nebraska. I remember after we lost the ASU game, they had actually signs of depression on the news. And one of them was like, you know, if you're beating your spouse, you're depressed. I'm like, holy cow, take things serious up here. But,
And
we had at that point won 25 or 26 straight football games before we lost to ASU. And so losing that obviously did deflate us a great deal. But once again, Saturday comes quick. And, you know, we've hit on a number of times throughout this whole interview is the consistency. The message still didn't change. You know, we lost a game. Hey, guys, we lost a game. We got another game on Saturday. Let's learn from our mistakes and do better this Saturday. And so that's how it was handled. It wasn't like, oh, you know, there wasn't any anger, you know, anything like that. It was just like, all right, we messed up. We didn't play our best game. And now let's go out there and make sure that never happens again.
Yeah, wasn't there, for the younger common fans that might be listening that maybe don't remember this, they maybe just remember win-loss records, but before that Big 12 championship game against Texas, wasn't there like a huge outbreak of food poisoning or flu or something like that on the team?
Yeah, the flu kind of hit us pretty hard. And then one of our guys got a DWI right before the game and we had to rotate. That's why Mike Minner ended up coming down and playing Will linebacker. So between the flu and having to rotate our whole defense around, we were kind of hamstrung to begin with. But still probably a game we should have won. You know, even when you're facing Priest Holmes and those guys, you know, we still had enough talent to win that football game had we played our best.
Yeah.
Tom, anything to add to that?
No, I just remember it was back then we were all a little spoiled in the media. And, yeah, I was hard on the team after that ASU game. But, you know, they played for the national title 3 straight years. And we just expected it to be every year. This is what Nebraska does. And it's going to – yeah, they lose all these guys, but they're just – the train's going to keep rolling. And it was just a nice little, you know, if that's an off year, it was, everybody should have that kind of an off year,
right.
But it was, yeah, a reminder that, okay, you know, you're not always going to win everything. And I thought the best reminder came from, Grant and his famous cohort, Jason Peter, after the season. And probably a story there somewhere, where maybe they got together and decided they were going to come back for one more year. And I think the focus was, you know, let's finish this right. And, you know, it was, you know, the Nebraska story wasn't quite finished. It was going to continue. But I thought that year was probably good in some ways to take a little breather. They still go to the Orange Bowl and they still dominate Virginia Tech. But, anyway, to me, that biggest story was after the season when those two legends got together.
Well, that's a nice segue. That's where I want to go next. And just again, side note: 11-2 in 2025, and they're dancing in the streets in Lincoln.
That's right.
So let's be clear on that. So there's so much intrigue every single one of these years. So a sort of a backdrop to all of this is that Coach Osborne had made a pledge to Frank Solich that he would only coach for 5 more years, and then he wanted Solich to get the head job. And that 5 years expired after the 1996 season. And then, so the story goes, which I'd love to ask you about, Grant. Grant Wistrom and Jason Peter meet with Coach Osborne together and tell him they'll be coming back for their senior years. They want to give it one more ride and win one more national title. And so T.O. Goes to Solich and basically says, "Hey, you mind if I have one more year and ride it out with this bunch?" Grant, can you share that story?
Yeah, it's a little bit different, but so Jason and I were roommates at the time, and both of us, you know, got people in our ear, you know, like, "Hey, if you leave now, you know, you're going to be, you know, first round pick, blah, 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 whatever." And, you know, neither one of us just wanted to be a first round pick. You know, it's like, we want to be a top 10 pick if we're going to walk away from this amazing university. And so we called up Coach Osborne and we just said, "Hey, Coach, we'd like to come in and talk to you." And he's like, "Yeah, sure, guys, come on in." So we walk in, we sit down and kind of laid it on the table to him, like, "Coach, you know, at some point this does become a business decision. And, you know, Jason and I have both talked, and we've decided if, you know, we think we're going to be top 10 picks, you know, we might need to go ahead and cash that check. But we're not really sure the information we're getting, you know, how biased is it? Is it people just blowing smoke, you know?" And he said, "Okay, Grant, guys, Jason, let me make a couple phone calls for you." So, you know, nothing hidden. He just started dialing numbers, hit it, put it on speakerphone. We're just having conversations right in front of us. And he called a couple of NFL scouts, and he, you know, two or three of them, I forget how many. And he just laid it on the table. Like, "Hey, I'm sitting here with Jason and Grant. They're thinking about leaving, you know, they're parameters, they want to be top 10 picks. Is that going to happen?" And he could have been calling his uncle for all I know. I doubt that he's doing that, but you know, the consensus was like, "Yeah, you know, these guys are good, but they're probably not top 10 picks." And so, you know, Jason and I just kind of said, "All right, Coach, well, we're going to be coming back next year." And the whole coach, you know, Osborne handing the reins over to Coach Solich, I had no idea about that until the book came out like 2 or 3 years later. You know, to think like, and that's just him. Once again, the consistency, you know, and lots, and I can't imagine how much his family had suffered in the last 20 you know, the last 25, 27 years, whatever it was, how much time away he'd spent from them. And it was fine. I'm sure he'd had numerous conversations with his family. I was like, guys, I'm done after this year. And I'm sure Nancy was incredibly excited about that. But man, to put all that on hold just to try to just be there for us again. It's like, wow, like what an amazing human being. Man, just once again, it just shows you he never puts himself above anybody. It's always about somebody else. And, you know, because I don't know if he'd have said, I'm not coming back, I don't think we would have come back, you know, regardless of what the outcome of that phone call would have been. I don't know. I was incredibly humbled, you know, when I heard when the story came out in the book, and just, I just appreciate it, 'cause he could have made that call and still stepped away and we'd have never known any differently. But man, he bit the bullet. And at that point then, you know, I really wished we would have known that it was going to be his last year, you know, I mean, we had a heck of a team. We played hard every Saturday that season. But to know that Coach Osborne, what he sacrificed to come back for one more year, I think that team would have been even more dominant. There wouldn't have been any split in a title.
Yeah. You see, common fans, when you listen to this show, you get the real story. Not like that not like that fake story from Rudy where they all came in and laid their jerseys down on the end. The real story.
Nobody cares about Notre Dame, Jeff. So the 97 season, as you mentioned, Grant, the team goes undefeated again, really dismantled number 3 Tennessee, the SEC champs, in the Orange Bowl. Peyton Manning led that team for the Vols. You know, there were some storylines that year. You know, they had the home win against Central Florida, a little bit closer than folks would have preferred. It was Dante Culpepper was their quarterback, if I recall correctly. And T.O. gives Frankie London a series in the first half at quarterback, which he had said he was going to do in advance of the game, get him some experience, you know, in time, in something other than mop-up time. Of course, he leads a scoring drive, and when Frost comes back in, the crowd is booing. That's a major story, and I think, I think that stayed with Frost for a long time. The next week, the Huskers manhandle number 2 Washington in Seattle. Frost really had a great game, kind of led the team to victory then. Then, of course, probably everyone's favorite memory is the miracle at Missouri, the flea kicker, whatever you want to call it, where the Huskers make a late drive down 38-31, score on the inadvertently kicked pass, and then win the game in overtime. That was like the first or second year of overtime, I think, so thank God for that. So before we get into sort of the split national championship discussion, and just Grant, we'd love to hear from both of you, really, Grant and Tom, sort of high points from that season, low points, memories, anything and everything from the 97 season.
Oh, well, yeah. My memories were just that it was going to be okay. They've got the defense. They've got the offensive line. They've got Amon Green. Do they have the quarterback? And certainly Scott played well in 96. The ASU memory people eventually got over. Maybe not. But the whole Frankie London thing was just, I think that was part of that was, I don't know if it was as much anti-Scott as, well, maybe it was, but, you know, I meant that everybody loves recruiting, and Frankie was one of these guys who was going to be the next superstar in Nebraska. And, you know, they wanted him out there. They wanted him to take over because they love recruits and they love the next big thing. The backup quarterback's always the most popular, so on and so forth. So, but to me, the Washington game was when, okay, this was a big time win, right next to Lake Washington. Brock Heward, Washington was pretty darn good, That was a big time win for Scott. I remember Tom put in two plays, including a quarterback keeper, maybe off a, I don't know what kind of play it was, but he put two plays in for specifically to help Scott and I think make him look good so he would answer the fans. That's how Tom answered the fans. I'll show you. And I did. This guy's the guy, and he's going to be the hero, and I'm going to set it up. And he did. I remember the Oklahoma game, the blowout where the Oklahoma coaches are coming back. The defensive coaches are coming back to the press box, and Milt Tenneper allegedly went down to the Oklahoma booth and said, "Here's how you stop the option." No idea what they were doing. It was like 69-0 or some kind of deal. And they had the fireworks and this famous hat that I still have.
Yeah.
The logo, the 250 win. That's an interesting point you make, Grant, about not knowing. If you'd have known, Tom would have been, that was his last year. How would that Missouri game, would that have been different? Would they have played better against Missouri? Would there have been more pressure on that game, on that situation? I can't imagine it. It was kind of classic Tom, but we did, he did it his way. He did everything his way, and it all worked out.
Yeah.
Grant, anything to add to that?
Oh, no, I think Tom hit on the two games that I remember most, the Washington game going in, and that was a, ABC game of the week, playing, beautiful day out, huge game, ended up putting Brock out of the game. And then
you're being humble. Yeah. You personally put Brock out of the game.
He gave me some one-fingered waves from the sideline after that. Yeah. That's all. And I ended up playing with him out in Seattle, and then I had some conversations with him about that. But he respects Nebraska football. I really do think I always liked when Brock commentated our games too, because yeah. I do think he appreciates Nebraska football. But that game and dang near giving it back when they put Tuiasa Sopo in there. I was like, man, we should have not knocked Brock out of the game. And then the Missouri game too. And just what I remember about the Missouri game, because Nebraska doesn't win football games like that when they're down and they got to drive the length of the field with 30 seconds left. We just don't. But once again, the consistency, the resolve, I feel like the biggest difference between the program then and now is those games then. Our attitude was, we're going to find a way to win it. Don't give a crap how much time's left on the scoreboard. Don't care what the score is. We're going to figure out a way to win this game. And I think that's what's lacking right now. Now it's the other way around. I think it's the 180 from that. It's like, how are we going to, what's going to happen? All right, we're ahead right now, but something's going to happen. So I just at that Missouri game, it was like, shit, don't care what the score is. We're going to win this game, guys. This is just what we do. Yeah. So those two games stick out the most, like Tom was touched on too, the Oklahoma game, the 250th win, and just beating the break. I think the final was like 70-7. I think that game is what won me the Lombardi Trophy and put me with the St. Louis Rams, because I believe Coach Vermeil was a commentator for that game, and he said, if I was ever running, in the NFL again, I would draft that guy. So, I think I had like 17 tackles, 3 forced fumbles and a recovery or something, just something ridiculous. But, those three games just what I remember from the season.
Well, you guys have been more than generous with your time. I want to end here. In preparation for this episode, I went back and watched the end of that year's Rose Bowl, and there's still 1 second on the clock, and Washington State never got a chance to kick a field goal from the 26-yard line. Nebraska, of course, splits the national title with Michigan. The question is not which team was better. The question is how many touchdowns would you guys have beat that Michigan team by?
Right. There's no question. And I played with a bunch of Michigan guys in the NFL, and, you know, they want to talk about it. It wouldn't have been close. You know, they squeak by a pretty substandard Washington State team. We blow out the number three team in the country. And what was awesome, I ended up playing with Leonard Little from Tennessee in St. Louis. And I asked him about the game, and his quote was, "You guys don't play real football. You never even threw the ball." So, yeah.
Leonard.
Right. You can beat somebody that bad, never throw the ball. You got a pretty good team.
Yeah. Scoreboard, Leonard.
Yep.
Thanks so much to Tom Chattel and Grant Wistrom. Any final thoughts from either of you guys?
No, this was fun. And I love to relive these things, and I appreciate you guys having me on.
Grant, anything else from you?
No, guys, thank you very much. You know, I don't get to talk about football too much in my house, so it's nice I get to come on here and just remember, you know, around my house, I'm just dad. Nobody cares about what I used to do. So every now and then this feels good to go back, walk down memory lane with people, and just relive some good times.
Although we don't have your accolades, we're all fathers, and we totally understand
that. Yes, we do.
Truly an honor and a privilege to have Tom Chattel and Grant Wistrom to help us talk about some of the greatest Husker teams ever. There will be at least one more episode in this TO series to kind of wrap everything up and put a bow on it. But for now, thanks so much, guys. Fantastic conversation. We will be back at you soon, Common fans. In the meantime, as always, GBR for life.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So whether you need to hire 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.